you're a California conservative, a libertarian, a moderate Democrat, believe in common sense, or just a sane person, this is the political podcast for you. It's the California Underground Podcast.
What's going on, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the California Underground Podcast. I am your host, Phil. Along with me, as always, is my trusty co-host, the best and fastest researcher in the West, Camille. And tonight, we have a special guest, and I think it's the first time in California Underground history that we've had previously a guest who was a candidate and now is elected to office. So this is a big deal. Assemblyman Josh Hoover of the 7th Assembly District. Welcome to the show. Josh, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm really excited to be back. I think my first time on must have been a good luck charm or something because we pulled off the race and now we get to be here actually getting to do some good work. So,
well, if you just keep spreading that around and then
I was going to say that.
We'll be lining up. People will be lining up to get on this show.
Spread the word.
Yeah, if you go on that California Underground show, you win your race. I don't know how that correlates, but anyway, we got a lot to cover tonight, and obviously we can talk about sort of your introduction to the assembly, how it's been going. But for those who are not familiar with who you are, why don't you give us a little bit of background of how you got into it and how you ended up in the assembly?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was previously a school board member in my community, so local. It was the Folsom Cordova Unified School District. I got elected to that in 2018. Turned out to be a really interesting time to get elected to a school board because then COVID hit and I was fighting to reopen our schools. We were the first district in Sacramento County to get our schools reopened for in-person instruction. And that was probably one of the biggest fights I've ever experienced. And I know, you know, yeah, it was a really tough time. And I've got kids that are in the schools. And so it meant a lot for me to get them back to in-person instruction. And then in 2021, the state redistricted the legislative districts. Kevin Kiley, who was one of the previous representatives for part of this seat, at least, ran for Congress. And then the state redistricted the districts. And what ended up happening is I ended up getting drawn into a very competitive district that was actually represented by a long-term Democratic representative, 10 years. He had been representing the district in the supermajority. And I took a run at it. And we were the first legislator to beat an incumbent in the supermajority since 2014. We were the only one last cycle to do that, and it was a very big lift. We got outspent by $3 million, but we were not outworked. We had a fantastic grassroots campaign. I thought we had a better message, and we won that seat, and I'm excited to be representing now the district where I grew up.
Awesome.
Good for you. That's amazing.
Yeah, so I don't know if I'd recommend it as a life choice, but it was a very, very intense year, but a very, very great victory.
Yeah, but that's really encouraging to hear.
Yeah, it was exciting.
Yeah, so I think it's always the feedback I always get about supporting any Republican candidate in California is, they're going to get outspent. They're going to get their teeth kicked in. It's not even worth it. But like races like yours are definitely inspiring because it shows if you have a good message, you connect with voters, it doesn't matter. You can be outspent and you want it and you beat them. And there is hope to beat big money in California, which probably scares unions and stuff like that. But it's a good sign that you can win that way.
You definitely can. I mean, it's, you know, I will say it was a slog. I mean, my opponent was probably spending $250,000 per week on television ads. Attacking me and we couldn't compete with that kind of money, right? But you know, at the end of the day, our message was pretty simple. We wanted to bring balance and common sense back to Sacramento. We were fighting for safe neighborhoods, great schools, and a more affordable place, you know, for our kids to live someday. And that's pretty much what we stayed focused on, and ultimately it won out over his negative messaging.
What could they have possibly said negative about you? You're such a nice guy anyway. So,
oh, well, they don't, it doesn't necessarily need to be true for them to say it. So, but I mean, they said I was anti-woman. They said I was, you know, tied to right-wing extremists and, you know, all this crazy stuff. I mean, they made up all kinds of stuff. So,
well, when all else fails, they just sling mud, I guess, in their case. But speaking of slinging mud, you've been spending some time in the assembly now, getting used to being an assemblyman. You worked in Sacramento before, correct? So you're kind of used to the scene, but now you're an assemblyman. Now you're in the thick of it, voting on stuff and being a part of the legislative process. What's it been like this first year getting used to being in the assembly?
You know, it's been really interesting. I mean, I've had to navigate kind of all the personalities in Sacramento. I would say that it's definitely different because, you know, being, I guess, in the decision-making chair, you kind of have to figure out how to be effective in a place as out of balance as Sacramento is. And so really tried to get to know my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, find ways to work together. We've had some victories. We've had some losses, but I would say overall it's going very well. I think we found ways to be effective. And I also have joined what's called the Problem Solvers Caucus in Sacramento in the Capitol, which is essentially 11 Democrats and 10 Republicans. And we actually get in the room together once a week and we talk about bipartisan solutions to some of our state's biggest challenges, which I think is an important, you know, thing that needs to happen. I think in our age of kind of hyper partisanship, we tend to go to our corners, which is sometimes justified. But I think at the end of the day, some of the best policy that needs to happen, you know, does, at least from my perspective, as in the super minority in Sacramento, needs to have bipartisan support. And so that's been a good way for me to kind of try to be effective as well.
Have you seen, I guess, there is this perception because it's a supermajority Democrats, and you think of a California Democrat, you may think of, I don't know, some of the Bay Area Democrats who are way out there. Is there more of a mix of maybe some moderate Democrats that do actually want to work with Republicans in Sacramento?
I mean, there certainly are Democrats that will work with Republicans. There are also some that won't, right? And you kind of got to find, that's kind of what, when I say navigating those relationships, I mean, that's kind of what I've been trying to figure out, right? It's like, how can, you know, who's available to work with, right? So, I mean, but yeah, overall, I think there's a handful of Democrats that are absolutely willing to at least hear you out. You know, one of the first things I put forward was a proposal to audit homelessness spending in California, and it wasn't received super well. We've spent $20 billion on homelessness since 2018, and we've seen the problem grow by 77% in our state. And so, you know, my big question was, well, if we're spending billions of dollars and it's getting worse, then, you know, where is all that money going and how could we use it more effectively? It wasn't initially received super well, but I actually teamed up with a Democratic legislator out of San Jose, and we were able to come to a bipartisan agreement, and we passed that with bipartisan support out of the audit committee. And it's now going to be completed in October, and we're really excited to see, you know, what information that gives us to help inform our policy moving forward. So I do think there's ways that you can be effective for sure.
You were explaining this audit process before we hopped on. It doesn't have to go to Newsom to sign off, right?
Yeah, that's so I sit on the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, and it's probably one of my favorite committees because, first of all, it's a really important tool when it comes to just oversight and accountability for the state, but in particular for the state agencies and programs that are run by the executive branch, you know, by Governor Newsom, right? And the great thing about it is when you introduce a bill in the legislature, you have to pass it through both houses and then get it signed by the governor. But with an audit, it just goes to one committee hearing. You have that committee hearing. And if you can convince your colleagues on that committee that this is important, and they pass it, the state auditor gets right to work and it just happens, and it doesn't need approval by the governor, which is a really important feature of the committee, because oftentimes we're auditing his programs and his agencies, right? So I think it's a really, really useful tool that is probably underutilized in California.
I want to audit. Like, sign me up to help audit. I'm not even kidding.
Right, right.
I'll do it for free.
I mean, there's so many great things. You know, it's we did the homelessness one, but we've also done, we passed an audit to audit the middle income tax credit program that was a total disaster. The EDD, you know, we've passed audits on just, you know, other big issues like that. Our roads, we actually passed an audit on where road funding is going, which I think is really good. So there, it's a really useful tool, I think.
I'd never heard of this committee before, so that's interesting to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a powerful tool. And I always wonder, you know, where does all that gas tax go when you drive over dilapidated roads over and over and over again? And their whole promise was, if we raise the taxes, we'll fix all the roads. Yeah. But I mean, I haven't seen roads be any marginally better since the gas tax has been since passed. So yeah, that's a very powerful tool. And I think, what's the committee makeup like? I mean, is there hope for more stuff to get audited or?
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, it doesn't, it's still pretty heavily Democratic. Mm-hmm. But I would say overall, most of the audits that I see, I would say 90% of them get approved. I mean, the ones that probably don't get approved are Republican audit requests, but you know, there's still ways to work with them to an extent and try to get some of the stuff done. And I think, you know, it also shows that, you know, the needle on homelessness is moving. I mean, I really think that Democrats and Republicans, I mean, Republicans have been kind of screaming this from the rooftops for a while, but I think Democrats, especially at the local level, are starting to wake up to, you know, how big of a problem this actually is. And the reason for that is because they're hearing it every single day from their community. I mean, when I've done a number of public like community meetings since I've been elected, and the top two issues are probably homelessness and roads. And that, you know, I think that's probably the case in a lot of communities in California.
Before I want to continue on this line of talking about homelessness, but just as a suggestion, throw it in the suggestion box. I'd love to see an audit of the bullet train and what happened with that.
Yeah, you and me both. I actually think that's been attempted, and it was, I don't think that one, although there have been a couple audits on that topic, I think, but nothing near what we need to see, but I totally agree with you. It's a mess.
I just want to see, is it as bad as True Detective made it out to be? I don't know if anyone else is a True Detective fan.
I have watched True Detective, yes.
That whole season.
That is actually really funny.
If people don't know, there's a whole season basically about California and the bullet train and where all the money went. But yeah, homelessness, and I agree with you. I think Democrats are facing this everywhere. And I think it's basically the polling and the public backlash has really kind of goaded Democrats into action. I think that's why you're starting to see a lot of Democrats take more hardline stances, encampments, issues like that. This care court, which Newsom is trying to roll out, shows like maybe a more hardline approach to homelessness. And it's interesting that it really had to come to their doorstep with Democrats before they finally had to do something. Meanwhile, we've been screaming about homelessness for 10, 20 years now, but now because it's not politically advantageous, Democrats are finally picking up the mantle for it.
No, I totally agree. I think it's definitely on the top of everyone's minds. I actually introduced a bill this year that was not successful, but it would have prohibited homeless encampments within 500 feet of schools and parks. Mm-hmm. And that was rejected by the Public Safety Committee, which is kind of a trend in the Capitol. But, you know, that's a policy that has been embraced by red and blue cities across the state. So, you know, it wasn't some crazy idea. I actually took it from cities like Sacramento and San Diego that had already done it. So, you know, I think the needle's definitely moving on that topic.
aren't there laws about sales of alcohol within a certain distance of schools? And I, right? But we don't know, not to say that all homeless people are alcoholics, but we don't know what's going on in their camps, drugs, alcohol, so close to the campuses. So that's odd that they...
No, it's really frustrating. I mean, I've personally found needles in the park where my kids play, right? And I think, you know, that is becoming more and more of a trend. And it's something that it's a public health and safety crisis, in my opinion, right? I mean, it's important to get people the help that they need, but it's also important that we're protecting the most vulnerable people in our community. And all we were basically saying is kids deserve an open path to walk to school safely. And to go to the park and play safely. I mean, I don't think that's really a lot to ask.
No, it's not.
So yeah, it's pretty frustrating. And I mean, there's a lot of other things we don't allow near schools. But previously, you know, when I was on the school board, we had homeless individuals that would, you know, come onto our campuses and talk to kids. And we had, you know, security issues like that. And so this is, I feel like, a pretty reasonable request.
Right. I remember as kids, you know, I grew up in California. I don't know if this was in other states, but they would say like, oh, be careful in the ball pit, like at McDonald's, because they would say that people throw their needles in there. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, yeah. Have you heard that? And now we're laughing, but now it's not funny. Like, it's actually their parks.
Yeah.
And the parks are public.
Yeah.
We're paying for those parks to be kept clean and secure, and then they're not.
Yeah.
And exactly. That's very sad.
It is really sad, actually. Yeah, I know, razor blades in the Halloween candy and stuff like that.
All right, yeah. I remember they would always say razor blades in the apples, which I'm like, I don't know how they got it into an apple and made it look so perfect. So I guess gauging the temperature in Sacramento on homelessness, especially with Democrats, on a scale of like one, they're not taking it super serious, to 10, you know, DEFCON 3, we got to fix this right now. Where do you think Democrats are right now in Sacramento on trying to do anything or fix homelessness?
I think they're still trying to figure it out. I will say up until this point, they haven't done much. You know, up until like last year, our main measure of, you know, homelessness response was how many dollars we've spent as a state. So, you know, Newsom would continually say, oh, we've spent this many billion this year, and I've committed this many billion next year. And with zero like framing of where the money was going, what kind of effect that money was having. Was it actually getting people out of the cycle of homelessness? Was it providing mental health? Was it providing substance abuse treatment? Nothing like that. It was just, how many dollars are we spending? And I think that was absolutely the wrong approach. This year, he's gotten a little more serious about it, potentially because he's running for president. I don't know why. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but you know, in San Francisco specifically, I mean, we've seen him send in the CHP. We've seen him send in, like, you know, do these different like responses to the crime and the homelessness that's going on in San Francisco. So I think that's been really interesting to watch. I think he knows this is probably an electoral liability for him. But at the end of the day, I mean, I still don't think that we're serious. And the reason I don't think we're serious is because our state is still committed to what they call, you know, or what is called the housing first approach to homelessness, which is essentially, you know, you get people into housing first and you deal with their other issues later. And those issues are generally dealt with on a voluntary basis. So people are not required to get clean. They're not required to go into treatment. And so what we're seeing is these problems continue to grow, I think, because of that approach. Of the $20 billion or so dollars that we've spent in the last 5 to 6 years, not a single dollar of that is eligible to go to programs that require sobriety. So there's actually a ton of programs in my community run by, you know, different nonprofits, St. John's Program for Real Change. There's something called Powerhouse Ministries Program for Homelessness in the city of Folsom. And all of them have actual requirements. They say, we're going to give you housing, but you have to come to us clean, and you have to get clean. And that's kind of one of the requirements that are put on the assistance that they get. That's not the approach our state's taking as a whole. And all that money we're spending is going to programs that don't have those same requirements. And so until we change that, I feel like we're not taking the problem seriously.
Yeah, because it must be tough for Democrats to, because they're kind of stuck in a rock and a hard place where they have the civil liberty groups on one side, which they have been so aligned with for so many years. But then they have the voters who are getting frustrated because they see it every day and that it just gets worse. So they have to kind of figure out, how do we do enough action to appease the voters so that they think we're doing something, but also not anger the civil rights group that supports us. So they're kind of in this rock and hard place. Like you're saying, they can't get too tough, because it'll be the civil rights people will come out and say, oh, you know, you can't do that. And the advocacy groups will come out and say, you can't do that. But not doing enough is not going to appease the voters. So they're really in a tough position, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see it. I mean, I think for them, they are in a tough position because of who they have to keep happy. But I think at the end of the day, you know, I mean, look, civil rights are important. I mean, we have to make sure we're preserving people's rights as well. But at the end of the day, we can go farther in terms of, you know, asking people to get treatment and get clean. And I think there's a lot of work to be done on that topic. It'll be interesting to see if it shifts over the next couple of years.
Speaking of money and audits, has there been any audits on where all the money for education is going, and we're, you know, failing as a state in the education department? And then I know you're on some education committees, and like you said, you were on the school board before, so this must be near and dear to your heart.
Yep.
Has anyone presented an audit on that, or?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I haven't seen any audits on that, but I can tell you, you know, to your point, I mean, I think I talk about this in just about every education committee hearing, being on the Assembly Education Committee, that, you know, we spend, we've increased our funding of education in California, something like $50 to $60 billion over the last decade per year. That's just like a per year number. And we continue to lag behind almost every other state in most of the major categories. We're 50th in literacy in the nation, in California, which I think is just completely unacceptable. We have eighth graders after COVID that are reading at a fifth grade level on average. We have tremendous amounts of learning loss because we had the longest school closures of any state in the country. So we were actually behind before COVID, and then we added the longest school closures in the country. So we're now even more behind. And I think what's one of the most interesting statistics is that the disparity in our state between the ethnic disparity. So our Latino and our Black children are actually farther behind than other students than in other states when you compare that same group across states. I mean, we're really failing on every single level. And yet our focus is on pretty much everything else but the basics, and actually getting back to the basics in education. You know, we're having these wars over curriculum, and, you know, we have people pushing really radical agendas in different, you know, the recent math framework and different frameworks. You know, we recently passed an ethnic studies graduation requirement, despite the fact that, you know, kids can't even read in California. I just think we're completely off base when it comes to focusing on where we need to focus in education and helping our kids.
Is there any solution? Is there any, I don't even know how to phrase my question. Is there any hope for this? Like, anytime soon?
I mean, look, I'm an optimist, so I'm always going to say there's hope. But I don't love the direction that we're going. I don't see, you know, I don't see a lot of the action that needs to be taken to fix this. And I don't see a big willingness. You know, one of the reasons is because the state's largest political contributor to political campaigns is the California Teachers Association. A lot of people don't realize that they actually give more political donations than any other organization in the state, which is pretty I think it's pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. And the thing with the CTA is that they fight to defend the status quo in Sacramento. It's that simple. They don't want to see competition. They don't want to see a lot of changes in California. You know, I really am a believer in school choice. I think families should have options on where they send their kids to school. But over the last decade, we've seen the legislation that's been passed has been legislation that has closed off those options, that has made it harder for things like a charter school to get approved, or, you know, harder for families to actually exercise options in education. And that's, you know, we're really going the opposite direction. And a lot of that is being pushed by special interests that have an interest in maintaining the status quo in California.
It is very unfortunate. I know there's different types of charters. I homeschool, and for a few years I was with a homeschool charter. It was technically considered that my kids were enrolled in public school, but they kept pushing and pushing where it was like, I'm Christian. I was allowed to buy faith-based curriculum if I spent my own dollars, and that was fine. I was willing to do that with a lot of the stuff, but I could use funds for putting my kids in like art and music and whatnot.
Yeah.
But then with the teacher that I would meet with, the requirements that they kept pushing were obviously public school requirements. And I understand they needed to have certain requirements to get the funding, but it came down to where I had to choose if I was going to teach my kids faith-based or go with public school funding. And I had to leave based on that, because it was like, I had to present with each kid the work that they had done that week, and the teacher could decide if it was enough. And so it was like, if I wanted to do faith-based science, I would have to double up because they could say, you know, wow, no, they didn't do enough. It wasn't acceptable. We had to do all the government testing. I don't believe in all that testing. I personally did well in school, but was never a good test taker. You know, and so for me, it was just like, I didn't want to push tests. I don't want to do all these tests. My kids actually did quite well. And I think that was not because of me, but just because the one-on-one time, you know, compared with 30, 40 students in a classroom, it was just me and my four children versus me and trying to get 30 other kids on the same page. So they tested well, but I didn't want them to be required. Like, that's not, I wasn't teaching them to be able to test well. That was never, one of the reasons why I homeschool. So unfortunately I had to leave that. And I know even the people that started it, they were very frustrated too, because eventually you have a lot of freedom, but the government just ties your hands and you have to do what they say to even get the funding. And then that's when the charter school fails or loses students, loses funding.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, the Charter Schools Act was passed in the early 90s to really provide more flexibility, right, and more options. And since that time, over the years, they've slowly tried to claw back the flexibility within the Charter Schools Act and apply more and more state mandates to charters as well as traditional public. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, we've certainly seen over the last probably 10 to 20 years, like a real reduction in that flexibility. And, you know, we do have still have some really great charter schools, but at the end of the day, the state's trying as hard as they can to make them, you know, align exactly with traditional public schools, and they're definitely losing their flexibility. So it's very frustrating. It's really undermining the whole goal of the Charter Schools Act, in my opinion. But
right. And I'm surprised it actually is so easy still to homeschool in California, but we don't get any kickbacks if we, you know, independently homeschool. It's all on us. We're still paying our property taxes and buying our own curriculum.
Yeah, I was actually independently homeschooled in middle and high school. So definitely familiar with that world. And there have been a couple efforts in California to rein that in, but they failed miserably. So I'm hoping that'll continue to be the case. Because yeah. I mean, you have to be able to do that. And, you know, that's just, I just think it's, if the state tries to go after homeschooling again, it's purely a money issue. It's purely them wanting to make sure that kids are in school so that they can, you know, get money for those students. I'm hoping that none of my colleagues touch that issue.
So being on school board previously, this past week, Gavin Newsom had picked another beef with another another group, the Temecula School Board, over the issue that they had voted on, that they did not want certain books to be read or be available. If you can correct me if I'm wrong about this. But the more important lesson that I take from that, which is scary to me, and you were talking about how the state really wants sort of almost complete control over students. I think it's kind of scary that you have the state stepping in and trying to circumvent or override a local school board's decision, which is, to use their own language, I believe that's a threat to our democracy when they won't allow local elected officials to make decisions for them.
I just want to step in really quick. Sorry, I'll let you answer, but they discussed it. It's actually being voted on or was voted on tonight. So Gavin opened his mouth and talked about that, but there was no official decision, which that could be the official decision, but that's tonight. So
that's really interesting. So I hadn't heard that part. Yeah, I mean, look, the state legislature and, you know, is continuously going after local control, trying to undermine local control. And I'm regularly making the argument in the legislature that, you know, do we really need a, I mean, honestly, half the bills that we see in the education committee don't need to be bills. They could easily be decided by local school boards. But state legislators, when you, I kind of like to joke that when you give 120 people full-time jobs to make laws, they're going to find laws to make, right? Like, I mean, that's just the reality of it. And that's how they act. And so they're like, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's make it apply to the entire state and every school district, regardless of the diversity of our state, whether it's ideologically, whether it's rural versus urban, it doesn't matter. We're going to apply this across the board. They're constantly trying to do that in a number of different ways. You know, this is one of those issues that has really taken hold in the media, especially. And, you know, this is one of those issues that really frustrates me because what most parents are asking for and begging for and going to their school boards and talking about is that they want age appropriate materials for their children. It's really that simple. And yet that is being painted by the left and by the media as, you know, Republican support banning books in schools across the state or whatever. And, you know, it's I think it's very disingenuous, the arguments that are being made on the other side. And it's really critical that we ensure that school boards maintain control over these important issues. We actually had a bill this year, AB 1078. I actually think it's still moving in the legislature that has been somewhat watered down, but it essentially would have required state board of education approval for any curriculum change at the local level of any kind. And it's authored by a new assembly member named Corey Jackson. I think it has been watered down a little bit, but it is absolutely insane what they're trying to do in Sacramento when it comes to stripping away local control, particularly when it comes to curriculum.
What baffles me, and I say this a lot, is that, you know, we send our kids to school. They're there to go. They're supposed to go to learn reading, writing, math, social studies. You know, it's what's supposed to be happening in school. School's not supposed to replace parents. It's not supposed to replace families. It's a place to go and learn specific things. And then if a school district decides this book is not age appropriate, we're not going to include this in our curriculum, everyone cries book banning. And it's like, go rent it from the library and read it to your kids if you care so much. You know, you know. So what if they're only supposed to be in school part time? The school is not your kids' parents. You want them to learn something outside of that. Then go pick it up and read it on Monday night. Like, you know?
Well, and this is at the same time when, you know, the left is pushing trigger warnings on just about everything across the board that has ever been created for college students, because, you know, college students need to be warned about the content, or that, you know, content may be too much for them to handle prior to watching movies or reading certain books. And yet they're claiming that Republicans are banning books. It's kind of ironic to me personally.
It is. Yeah, that's a lot.
No, but it's
another reason I homeschool.
No, it's very frustrating, and I definitely am fighting to try to maintain that local control, but we'll see. I honestly don't know what's going to happen with this thing with Temecula and the governor. I will say that the California School Boards Association came out, and I don't have it in front of me right now, but they basically came out, and this is not a right-leaning organization. They came out and said the governor really doesn't have the authority to do this, what he's trying to do. I mean, this is an organization that, they're a very large education organization in California that doesn't really, I'll be honest, doesn't speak out on a lot of these issues. And they came out and they said the governor doesn't have the authority to do this. So I think that says a lot about what the governor's trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, if it's anything like most of Gavin Newsom's political stunts, he comes out with a bang, fizzles away, and he's on to the next controversy in about a week. So we'll forget about this, and he'll be on to picking a fight with DeSantis or Trump or something like that by next week. So,
yeah, that's a pretty good description of his term so far. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I tweeted last week, I think, about how his watchdog went into effect recently with the price gouging and all of that stuff. And I haven't seen prices come down in California. In fact, the only reason prices has gone up is because of the gas tax that went into effect on July 1st. So, again, another political stunt that didn't really do anything, didn't really show or solve the problem, but it looks good for the national media when it comes to Gavin Newsom.
Yeah,
it allowed them to go after the oil companies. But even when you talk to Democrats, I mean, I've talked to Democrats offline about that whole push, and all of them agreed it did absolutely nothing other than give the governor a megaphone to talk about the evil oil companies and to talk about price gouging, when in reality, it was just a distraction from the fact that we have the highest gas taxes in the entire nation. They went up again, like you mentioned, in July. And we're 46th in road quality in the country. So we have the fourth worst roads in the country, and yet we pay the highest gas taxes. I think is what upsets people the most. I mean, obviously they don't like the high gas taxes, but it's the fact that they pay the most and get the least in return. Mm-hmm. I think that is what upsets people even more than the high gas taxes.
Yeah, I think it's in a way, I don't want to get too far off track because you're our guest, but this will be my last comment about Gavin Newsom. In a way, it's almost a silver lining because he's trying to run for president. So he's mediated a lot of his stances and he's come out more moderate in a lot of things. But also it gives us fodder every week because he has a new political stunt that he has to pull off to remain relevant in the news. Actually, in coming out moderate on one controversy, he did come out in a moderate position on the issue of SB 14, which raised national news. And I know you're not on that particular committee, but I think it would have been interesting to get a perspective what it was like in Sacramento when this was happening, because there's just so much media spotlight on Sacramento about SB 14 to cause them to kind of do this 180.
Yeah. So for those that weren't aware of SB 14, I mean, it has really been the story for the last week or so in Sacramento. It was a bill authored by a Republican from Bakersfield, Senator Shannon Grove. She got it through the state Senate 40-0 on consent. I mean, it was full bipartisan support. This bill, it had been a bill she had tried a couple times throughout the years. She finally got it to a place where both parties were okay with it in the Senate. She gets it over to the Assembly. So basically what the bill does in its current form is it makes human trafficking of a minor, not general human trafficking, but human trafficking of a child, a serious felony in California. What does that mean? Well, it's currently a felony in California, but it does not fall under the state's three strikes law, meaning that when we have this law that we've had since the 90s, three strikes and you're out. and you can qualify for a much more stringent prison sentence upon your third strike. And so by making it a serious felony, this bill would basically say that if, you know, for repeat offenders, and that's an important distinction, for repeat offenders of human trafficking of a minor, you can go to prison for a very, very long time. And I think that is something that if you polled it, you would probably get broad support for in this state. Well, it wasn't good enough for the Assembly Public Safety Committee. It got to the committee and was defeated in the Assembly. I believe, I'd have to go back and look, and maybe you know, but I believe that the Democrats abstained on the bill and basically just killed it without a vote.
Yeah.
The two Republicans supported it on the committee.
Yes.
And it really became a huge story. And it led to something that I have never seen. I've been in and around California politics for the last 12 years. I have never seen this happen, which is the Assembly Public Safety Committee changed its mind on something. And so the day after, so that was, that bill died on a Tuesday. Shannon Grove almost immediately, I think it was the next day, got a call from Governor Newsom. And I actually ran into Shannon in the Capitol. And I said, you know, what did the governor say to you? And she said, well, I was sitting in a meeting. I got the call. It said Gavin Newsom on my phone. So I was like, I better take this. So she answered it. And the governor said that he was very upset by the failure of that bill and that he wanted to help make it right. And him and the speaker, the new speaker of the assembly, Robert Rivas, engaged on the issue. Another thing that I'm not used to seeing in Sacramento is that two pretty powerful Democrats engaged and basically told the Public Safety Committee, you have to hear this bill again and you need to vote differently. And so 2 days later, I was actually in the committee hearing with my daughter. She happened to be at the Capitol with me. It was kind of I just had taken her to work that day to show her kind of what was going on. And it turned out to be one of the craziest days of the year. And so her and I went to the committee hearing and sat there, and the chair of the committee, Reggie Jones Sawyer, sat down to start the hearing. He said, there will be no testimony. There will be no, basically no commentary of any kind on the bill. They were going to do a vote only. And they went around and they voted it out. There were still two Democrats that abstained, but it had enough votes to get out of the committee. And then when we come back to legislative session in August, we're going to get a chance to vote on that as a full assembly after it gets through the Appropriations Committee. So, you know, I mean, honestly, it was one of the craziest things I've seen. And I would say it was one of those rare opportunities where Republicans actually got a huge win, because it was Republicans that were leading on that issue, including Shannon Grove and James Gallagher and the rest of our caucus.
I don't even see how that's not a nonpartisan issue. Like how any, you know, but it just feels like they're playing games. I want to know, and I know I can look it up, but if you know off the top of your head, who are the two that abstained? Because they still need some phone calls. People need to.
So the two Democrats that abstained, one of them was Assembly Member Isaac Bryan from Los Angeles. And the other one, interestingly, was Assemblywoman Mia Bonta, who is the wife of our Attorney General, right. Rob Bonta, which to me, you know, I don't know. To me, that says a lot. This is, you know, as an Attorney General, and obviously she's not the Attorney General, but, you know, our Attorney General is literally our state's top law enforcement officer. Mm-hmm. You know, his job is to keep kids safe from human trafficking and a number of other things. Right. And so I was a little dismayed that it didn't get full support. Right. Especially after coming out of the Senate 40-0, which by the way is not, there are a lot of very progressive people in the state Senate. So this wasn't something that was, you know, some crazy right-wing bill, right? According to them, right? This was a bill that got support from every progressive member of the Senate. So it was really, really upsetting to see that.
Yeah, I'm really, I'm really glad with how that turned out so far, but it's ridiculous that it got there. Embarrassing, sad, pathetic.
All of the above.
I think I actually saw a picture of, I believe it was Shannon Grove, hugging our favorite state senator, Scott Wiener.
Yep.
We say that in cheek, obviously. So that's how unanimous it was. When you describe it, that it was, they're only making it so that if you get three, if you're a repeat offender of child human
second
trafficking,
second time offense, yeah.
Yeah, if you're a repeat offender, it should be your first offense should be a serious penalty.
Yep.
So it's not even that draconian or that harsh.
Yeah.
That's insane to me. I think that's probably why it got so much public attention across the country. It was like, this is how wild California has got. Do you think you can be honest? We appreciate the honesty. Do you think that bill got reintroduced because of public backlash, or do you think it was because people thought it was the right thing to do?
I think it was in large part because of the public backlash. Yeah. But I really do believe that it got a lot of attention, and the media actually covered it, I think, in the right way.
Your voice matters.
Yeah.
Everyone listening, your phone calls, your emails, they matter.
They got flooded with calls. They got flooded with, we've seen backlash on a lot of different bills. This was probably the biggest one. I mean, we had Democrats on Twitter who were yelling at the Public Safety Committee. I mean, it was a pretty unprecedented level of public outcry.
And I guess give credit where credit's due, even though it's not his thing, but Gavin Newsom did make the phone call and say, hey, you guys are going to go in and vote differently.
Yeah. And, Gavin Newsom may have done that. I mean, I want to believe that Gavin actually thought this was ridiculous. And, he's a father, right? He has young kids. I fully believe that he thinks this is the right policy. But I think the bigger credit, because you could say that, this could have cost him some political points at the national level had this, continued to go the way it was. But I think the bigger credit actually goes to our new speaker, Robert Rivas, who I think still has a long ways to go in showing exactly how he's going to lead the assembly. But he actually stepped out that the day after that and said that he wanted to make this right. And he's not running for president, right? I really felt that he engaged immediately and pretty swiftly on this. And that was good to see, because we need, he got sworn into, I think, as speaker 13 days prior or something like that.
That's what I thought. I'm like, he's brand new.
He's brand new. And so everyone's kind of waiting to see, how is this guy going to lead the assembly? He made some comments in his swearing in speech that, he said, look, doing the right thing sometimes requires working with people you don't always agree with. And I appreciated that. But it's kind of one of those things you want to wait to actually see it, mm-hmm. right? Like, I'm not going to take someone at their word. I want to see what you do. And, to his credit, he engaged on it, which I thought was really good.
I hope he keeps that up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about a warm welcome to your new job as speaker. That's like the first thing right off the bat is this big controversy. I think public backlash is a perfectly acceptable answer. And I think it's a great answer, because it does give people hope that you can call up these offices and let people know, and all of a sudden that it can change their mind. And I, like you said, there's been bills in the past where there's been a large grassroots activism where they're posting numbers, they're saying call the offices and stuff like that. And you'll see politicians switch or back off or let a bill die because of people calling in. And I think that's important for people to know, is that, there are people on the other line. When you do call your office, there are people on the other line, and they hear the calls. So it's not just a robot.
And honestly, at the very least, and this is just, I like to tell people this, because at the very least, it'll make them think twice the next year when they are looking at something super controversial to introduce. Mm-hmm. And they know in their head, if I introduce this, I have to be ready for a fight. I have to be ready for committee hearings that last hours and hours because people are going to be that angry about it. I think it's important to remind our leaders that, we're not going to let you do this without, some public input. Right. And it makes them at least think twice the next time they want to introduce something really crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's important because people feel kind of dismayed that there is such a supermajority in Sacramento. They feel, there's nothing I can do. But you can call up and you can definitely let people know and you can weigh in and push and get some bills changed up a little bit. So that is kind of an inspiring message.
Yeah, it's the human trafficking bill was a good example of that. We also stopped a bill this year that would have banned, essentially defunded school resource officers, school police officers in California this year. We stopped the police canine ban. I don't know if you guys talked about that at all on this podcast. That bill got defeated this year. We stopped a bill that would have stripped law enforcement of the ability to use consensual searches in the field. And so, there are bills that the public still, has an impact on. And so it's not always doom and gloom.
So everyone listening out there, be ready to pick up the phone and call, call the assembly, bombard Sacramento whenever you see a bill. And we do our best to try and get stuff out there and get information out there.
We'll try to be better about that too.
We try to do the grassroots call to actions and stuff like that. So that's important as well.
That's really good.
We got about a couple minutes left before the hour. I want to finish up by just kind of asking you, what are your goals for the rest of the year? Now that you're kind of settling into your role in the assembly, what are some big goals that you want to achieve in this next year or even also in next year in your term?
Yeah. I think I mentioned, my goals are pretty straightforward. I mean, I think we have to tackle the homelessness crisis in California. I am going to continue fighting for our schools and education to make sure that families have choice and options. Honestly, get the politics out of our classrooms. It was interesting. There was a bill this year that would have kind of, it was actually a penalties bill, which is, I thought was kind of funny, that would have increased penalties on harassment of teachers, which, I personally don't have a problem with that bill. But one of the points that I made when that bill was brought before our committee was, if the goal is to turn down the temperature at the local level when it comes to our schools, then get the politics out of the classroom. We keep yelling at these angry parents, right? We being our leaders in the state, these angry parents at school board meetings. Well, why are they angry? Because you're injecting things into the classroom that should not be there. And so, I think that's going to be an ongoing, battleground over the next couple of years, getting the politics out of the classroom and getting back to actually teaching our kids how to read and write, and making sure families have choice. So, that'll continue to be a big priority of mine. And then the last thing, obviously I've done a lot of work on the public safety side. So bills to reform Proposition 47, bills on homelessness, as I mentioned. But the last thing I think we really need to tackle is our affordability crisis in California. I'm really worried that our state is quickly becoming a place where my kids aren't going to be able to afford to live. And I would hate my kids to have to move to a different state in order to purchase a home, in order to build generational wealth, in order to raise a family. I want them to be able to do that here in California. And I think we've really lost the message on that. Our state is becoming less and less attainable to do those things. And we have to figure that out and find ways to reduce the costs in our state. And in a lot of cases, that means government has to get out of the way. So, I think those are my, broader priorities, but I'm really excited for the opportunity and excited for what's to come in the next few years.
I keep nodding my head, but I'm so with you on that with my own kids. you know, they're growing up and I want them. Like, I'm just like, you guys can all just live here forever. Not really. But, you know, if they want to move, I understand they want to move and do different things, but I don't want them to have to move. I hope that they want to stay nearby, you know, and raise their own families here. My parents are like 2 miles away and I love that my kids get to see them all the time. You know, they have a great relationship with my parents and it's so fun. And I hope to have the same with my own grandkids someday.
Well, and as crazy as California is politically, I mean, I love this state, right? And I want, that's why I'm still doing this, because I believe in this state. I believe that we can get back to a better place. And it's because I love this state and I want it, you know, I want it to return to some level of sanity.
Yes.
Yeah. I think I've mentioned this before, and this has become like a running thing on the show. My wife and I actually went and looked at houses earlier this year around February, and we just got completely dismayed at the fact that we weren't looking for anything crazy, but, and we both have good jobs. We both work hard. We both have good credit. We got like the loan companies were tripping over themselves to pre-approve us for a loan. And we looked at it and we're like, it's just not affordable. It's just not affordable for us, which is sad. And it's like, we're sitting here looking at each other like, if we can't afford houses, who's affording houses in California? So the affordability thing is just,
I don't know.
It's insane. You look around and go, how do people live here anymore?
It is crazy. My wife and my three kids and my two giant dogs, we squeeze into our 1200 square foot house, and we would love to get a bigger house, but it's just not on the table for us. And, you know, I just think it's unfortunate, because I think there's it didn't used to be that way. And I think it's a lot of policy decisions that have made it that way. So,
yeah,
I've been a stay at home mom for almost 18 years. And now I'm like, sorry, kids, I know we used to just go grocery shopping and buy groceries. Now it's like, okay, stick to the list, because it's crazy how I was trying to explain to them. I'm like, everything costs more. This drive to the grocery store is costing us more. I'm like, and our paycheck, my husband's paycheck hasn't gone up. So sorry, you know,
yeah, very frustrating.
I mean, I grew up on the East Coast, and my vision of California, and probably most people's vision of California was the land of, opportunity. It was that whole go West young man, you know, it was the gold rush. Mm-hmm. It was this idea of like, you went to California, it was a thriving economy. You could you can get the American dream out here. It was just full of opportunity and everybody wanted to go to California. Now, that's definitely not the view. And that's the sad thing, is we've gone from that shining kind of city on the hill to complete collapse at this point.
Did you see the story? We're projected to lose like 5 congressional seats by 2030.
No.
I mean, that's, I mean, that says it all, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people are fleeing the state, and you know, the governor or the legislature can deny that all they want, but the numbers don't really lie.
Right.
Yeah. And a dwindling tax base only hurts their long-term goals of spend. So, I mean, we could talk about that. We talked about it a little bit with the budget and stuff like that.
Even the governor's trying to move, you know,
that's true. He's trying to move to the East Coast. I think maybe there might be a vacancy. There's a 1600 Pennsylvania way, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But yeah, I don't even think California is ready for a recession. If that were to happen with revenues and the way it is with our budget. So I think California would be in big trouble if there was a recession, and I don't know how they, I mean, you're in the assembly, so you guys would be kind of digging your hands in there and getting dirty to figure out what you have to cut and what has to be cut back to.
Yeah. Next year, I will just say, I'll preview this. It's going to be a lot worse than this year. So what the projection show. I mean, our budget is probably going to be in a worse position next year than it is right now. And we're already facing a pretty big deficit, about $30 billion as it is. So not good.
Awesome. Well,
yeah. Well, to end on a cheery note,
let's end on a cheery note. Josh, thank you for coming on. Where can people find more about you and follow you? Because I think, and this is my opinion, I think you're part of a new wave of young Republicans who are coming into the assembly with new ideas, fresh ideas. which is amazing to see. And I think we need that. I think we need that in Sacramento to kind of shake things up. So where can people go and find you, follow you, learn more about you?
Yeah. So I've got my Twitter up here on the screen at @Joshua_Hoover. And you can pretty find me at that on Instagram and Facebook as well. So, you know, definitely on social media. Also, you know, I'm doing this weekly kind of podcast thing, not to pitch a different podcast, because you got to listen to California Underground first, and then you can listen to my podcast. But it's just like I'm giving weekly updates on what's going on in Sacramento. So it's like at Point of Order Pod. But, you know, I think overall, you know, I agree with you. I think we need new voices in California, and we need, you know, I think we need a new generation that's willing to kind of shake it up. And so excited to be a part of that movement.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on. As always, the door is open. Whenever you have something you want to come on and talk about, feel free to reach out and let us know.
I appreciate it. Yeah. And I'm happy to come on anytime if you guys want to chat about stuff going on. And look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
And make sure you spread that rumor that if you go on the California Underground podcast, you're likely going to win your race. So there's that correlation.
Yeah. Oh, no, that is really good, actually. Yeah. So
we'll be my email box will be full after that. People coming, hey, can I come on? Even Democrats will be
all kinds of guest requests.
The winner's circle right here.
Yeah. Democrats will be, hey, can I come on? Sure.
I'm going to say that there's no way to disprove this, right?
That's true. Yeah, disprove a negative that we did not help your campaign. All right, Josh, thanks for coming on again. Make sure to follow him on Twitter. Check out his podcast as well. I'm going to go subscribe to it and make sure I check in every week, because I want to.
We're going to start a new episode every week where we critique your episode. We'll do a secret episode. This week.
We'll check in on your episode.
We don't even have to do any research. We're just going to use your podcast.
Well, fun fact, Governor Newsom is actually my constituent too. So, you know.
Oh,
wow.
You're listening.
That is actually, that's really one of the, you should have opened with that.
I know. I actually forgot, but that's one of the fun things I like to mention.
So if he has really to complain to his representative.
He still hasn't called me. In fact, I've never even got a chance to sit down.
You should meet up with him for coffee and donuts.
I should.
I wonder if it irks him that his representative in Sacramento is a Republican, that he has to call and reach out to. But
one can hope.
One can hope. Just the little things. But yeah, make sure you follow Josh, listen to his podcast. And as for this podcast, if you're a fan of this podcast, make sure to like, share, subscribe, review, all of that stuff. Share it with friends. Best and free way to support this show, send it to somebody who would be interested. Spread the word about it. And with that, have a good night, everybody. Later.
Thank you for listening to another episode of California Underground. If you like what you heard, remember to subscribe, like, and review it. And follow California Underground on social media for updates as to when new episodes are available.